Welcome back to the Roundtable. I'm Sarah LaDuke. Jennifer Simard is glowing and growling, stunning and striving, 8 shows a week as Helen Sharp in Death Becomes Her at the L'Enfantin Theater on Broadway.
Did you see her when she saw us? I could feast on that for days. She was jealous, green with envy, when I said, my fiancé. So delicious, so addicting, so organic. I think we just had us a change in status. She used to send me spiraling into a hopeless place, but now I get to shove my happy love life in her face.
Wait, I thought she was like your oldest friend.
Oh, she is. I love Mad. Love her like a twin who stole my nutrients in the womb.
Based on the Robert Zemeckis-directed camp classic film from 1992, Death Becomes Her features music and lyrics by Noel Carey and Julia Mattinson, and a book by Marco Panett. It's directed and choreographed by Christopher Gattelli, and Simard's co-stars are Megan Hilty, Christopher Sieber, and Michelle Williams. Jennifer Simard's Broadway credits include, but are not limited to, Shrek the Musical, Disaster, Hello Dolly, Mean Girls, and Company. She was nominated for Tony Awards for her performances in Disaster and Company. Her talents have also been employed in many notable off-Broadway productions and on screen. The now 3-time Tony Award-nominated actor, Death Becomes Her received 10 Tony Award nominations this month, is also a Webby Award-winning podcast co-host with Patrick Hines for the Golden Girls Deep Dive podcast. To paraphrase a saying popularized by Chapel Roan last year, Jennifer Simard is your favorite theater person's favorite theater person, and she joins us now. Jennifer, welcome to the Roundtable. Thank you so much for being here. I'm very excited to speak with you for a bit.
Sarah, the gratitude is all from my direction. Thank you for talking to me. It is truly an honor.
Congratulations on your most recent, not first, but most recent Tony Award nomination.
Oh, thank you so very much. I am just beside myself with gratitude. You know, this is an incredible honor, especially this season, because there are just innumerable brilliant performances. So I'm very grateful to the nominating committee for seeing fit to include me.
What does it feel like when you do find out that you've been nominated, and how do you process it as a you know, theater person? It's probably, you know, something you thought about a lot before it ever was something that entered your exact rotation. How does it feel when you do hear your name associated with a nomination?
That's a great question. As with anything in life, it's different every time. If you're lucky enough to say that every time, you'll know what I mean. There's nothing like your first nomination. There is a wide chasm between 0 nominations and a nomination, right? But every subsequent nomination I've had, the second and now the third, rang significant in a very special way to it. For example, Company rang very special to me because that was the pandemic show. That was the show that I had done 12 performances of before the world shut down. And as you might remember, we never knew if theater would even come back, let alone humanity, right?
Mm-hmm.
To come back at all and then make it all the way to the big show, the Tony Awards of 2022, was very emotional. And this one is very emotional for me because it is about the work, and I won't go into too many details, but the last 2 years I've unfortunately had to go through an amicable but painful divorce. And so there's quite a bit about the character of Helen Sharp that I actually relate to right now at this phase of my life. So to know that I was able to open this musical and as a co-lead of the show, carry the weight of that on my shoulders, because this part is new for me. I've never been a leading lady before. That rings different. And so this nomination rings different. And luckily I've had the very best examples of leading individuals about how to behave. And I hope I do justice to the example and lessons they set for me.
It feels to me like the real partnership of the show is you and Megan. And that's not to diminish the work Chris is doing, of course, but that you and your and Megan characters are on a, you know, you have a lot of power. You are running him around and you're evolving and changing. It feels almost like Helen is a number of different women throughout the course of the show. What has it been like to build that and focus on it and support each other as two like really out there, hilarious, bold, and demanding characters on stage?
All right. So there's a lot of facets to that question, and I'm going to try to go down each lane just a little bit. Christopher Sieber is charged with doing a lot of listening and reacting, and nobody does it better. And it takes great discipline to let your ladies shine, right? Christopher is one of the funniest men I know. And one of the disciplines of comedy is knowing when to put your foot on the gas and knowing when to tap the brakes. And in my view, that's a lot of what Ernest Menville's character has to do. As far as Helen goes, you are correct when you say it's like many different women in the show. I have always felt like it's a bit of a retrospective of my career, you know, because it even though she's one woman, she's maybe five different people or so, five or six different women over the course of the night. And so it's very thrilling that you picked up on that. As far as you know, being bold, I forgot the adjective you used, but sometimes we're charged with doing very broad camp comedy. And in that, that doesn't necessarily mean large and huge. I've always been of the school that less is more very often, and you must let the audience come to you. You must invite them to get to know you as opposed to shoving it in their face. Sometimes you have to, but as long as it's based in truth, the audience, in my view, is very willing to be the other actor with you in that moment. And I have found that to be true. And as you rightly pointed out, this ultimately is a love story between these two women, between Madeline Ashton and Helen Sharp, and finding your person. And it's not necessarily a romantic relationship. Your person can be your best friend. It can be a colleague. And, you know, I think in life we have a lot of pressure to make it a romantic thing, and it doesn't always have to be. So I think it's a beautiful lesson that we didn't anticipate being there necessarily, but it's there nonetheless. And as far as working together and helping one another, everyone has a different process. It's very important to have a lot of respect for one another. And the way I like to operate is to love people the way they wish to be loved, as long as it doesn't, you know, cost my soul too much. Everyone is different, and maybe someone doesn't speak my love language. So I'm always trying to find out, how will this work? And I mean that in the work as well. Like, what do you need from me in this moment? Let's see how this can work for both of us, that kind of thing. And it's been a real pleasure to work with colleagues who are very generous and kind.
What is your love language?
My love language is empathy. It's seeking first to understand, then be understood.
That's a fantastic place to work from, I think. Not that you need me to say that, because you're operating your own life. When did you know, how did you discover that you could be and were funny?
I believe I got it from my late mother, Yvette, and she was funnier than I was, and she wasn't in the business. There was this short-lived TV show, kind of like the Newlywed Game, called Who Knows You Best, where you'd answer, one of you would leave the room and you'd answer the question the way you think they would answer it. And one of the questions was, which of you would Yvette, my mother's name, which of you would Yvette say is funnier? And I wrote my mother, Yvette. She came back in. So which one did Jennifer say is funnier? My mother looked at me. She was like, I said me. Sorry, Jen, I said me. No, you're right. So I knew, you know, from inception that I had that gene in me. And it only got stronger and stronger over the years, believe it or not, when I got in touch with pain and, you know, emotional pain. And I think I used humor quite a bit to cope with that. And so I think I was always there from a very young childhood age, but it only got more honed with deeper experience, which is a bit of a dichotomy. But I think a sad clown is a bit more interesting than just a happy clown.
Our guest is Jennifer Samard. She is currently playing Helen in Death Becomes Her on Broadway. There is a lot of physicality in this show, scanning my memory. Maybe every show you've done has had a ton of physicality in it.
Yeah.
How do you, you know, keep safe, keep comfortable, keep from injuring yourself? I know that obviously people work with you on that, but how do you continue to perform and throw yourself around this way?
Yeah, sometimes injuries are inevitable. I actually sustained one early on in the run, such that for a while I had to stop flipping backwards over the couch. But it's back in now because I've healed. And it's a lot of, you know, maintenance, physical therapy. Very blessed to have a very safe fight captain in my friend Ryan Wersing. And certainly what happened was nothing to do with what he did. It was something else. But he always makes me feel safe. My partners make me feel safe. And just yesterday, Sarah, I do a lot of outside things to make sure I can do the show. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I do is a cryotherapy tank for trying to stand there for up to 3 minutes. And you're in a lot of protective gear. That's essential so you don't have frostbite. But yesterday I made it to 2.5 minutes to the song Wake Up by Rage Against the Machine. It really helped. Thank you for their service because it helped me stay there for 2.5 minutes and reduce my body temperature by 40 degrees, which helped my body heal so I could do the show.
It requires so much commitment. I think people don't often realize what you have to do to be able to keep doing that all the time.
Correct.
And in the stunning, but also potentially at times heavy costumes of Paul Tazwell, can you tell me about working in these gorgeous costumes? Because they're such a part of the show.
Yes. He's such a gentleman. I believe he's the first African-American man to win an Oscar for costumes.
Mm-hmm. For Wicked.
I would put my money on him to win costumes in the Tony Award category this year for our show, or at least he, as brilliant as everyone is, he would have my vote because I know firsthand what went into them. I'd also like to say, it's more of a question than a statement. Why is it always the people who are the best at what they do, who can be non-reactive, communicative, and helpful without any sort of ego attached and any sort of defensiveness, but are always looking to make solutions instead of problems? I would argue that Paul Tazwell is exactly that kind of individual.
He's one of those dream unicorn people.
Yeah, just calm in a storm and gets it done in a way that makes you feel like $1 million and look like $1 million. So his designs, in my estimation, are never compromised from a vision point of view, but always in a way that makes, I'll speak for myself, that makes me, the actress and the woman, feel like the costume is just an extension of my character. And I feel beautiful in every single look he's put me in, especially the hospital gown. Wow. I feel Gorgina in that.
You do look good in everything. I mean,
oh,
if we're being honest. This is Chris Gattelli, Christopher Gattelli's first time directing a show for Broadway. He's choreographed a number of times. Had you worked with Chris before or knew him from being in the community?
I've auditioned for Chris before. I've come within millimeters of being in one of his shows a couple of times. This is the first time we've actually gotten to play in the sandbox for real. And of course, we started by doing one of the readings together, and then it was all she wrote from there. Yes, this is his first time directing a Broadway musical. I would hazard a guess it is not his last. He is wonderful. He is wonderfully kind. I had the privilege of meeting his mother a few weeks ago, and we told her as such. You know, she raised a very fine young man. While talent is important, I think I would argue the other side is even more so. And it was a pleasure. It is a pleasure.
I have to mention one of my favorite performances of yours, because I have this wonderful opportunity to get to bring it up. You were in an episode of Girls 5 Eva as the Airbnb owner, and it was so funny. What was it like to work on that show, to get to show up in that? I know that you were in Mean Girls on Broadway, so that could be a connection to Tina Fey and stuff, but tell me about that.
Well, your timing is perfect. In fact, I had breakfast with Tina yesterday. We've become friendly. You know, we're only 3 months apart in age, and that just sort of bonds you. When you remember the gypsy moth infestation of 1979, it bonds you.
Sure.
But no, I had to audition for the show, and I was happy that I got it. I had auditioned for a couple of the roles in the regular cast, and that didn't pan out in my direction, but this guest spot did. And when I read and saw who Daphne was, I'm like, oh, this is the right fit. This is perfect. Yes, I loved Daphne in the closet. And of course, we filmed it during the pandemic. So again, everything at that time felt like such a gift, right? We filmed it in a week, I think, in December of 2020. And I just love wacky Daphne in the closet, peeing in an Easter basket grass, right? In her Airbnb closet.
Incredibly sanitary.
Oh my God, she's a wacko. I loved her so much.
You think that there is, and this is really outside of either of our expertise, but since it's come up a couple of times already, do you think that there is outstanding, unaddressed impact from the pandemic that maybe, I don't know if I mean like society on the whole or the theater community specifically, or that we aren't addressing, that we aren't looking at, that we aren't
Yeah.
being allowed to recover from?
Oh, unquestionably, in many aspects, and I can't possibly focus on all of them. A, because we don't have time. B, because you don't know what you don't know. I'm sure
Right.
I have gaps. A couple things do pop to mind though. The lost generation of young actors or artists in the creative industry at all who will never now move to New York City because of the timing of that, right? When you
Right.
can only imagine how many people just ended up doing something else. I will say something that interests me a great deal, always has, is psychology and mental health. And in my view, human beings aren't meant to live in that kind of sustained red alert for that long. And if I don't do this for a living one day, I have aspirations of I'm probably going to be that old lady, Sarah, with my hair up, held by a pencil. I'll have lots of turquoise and chunky amber with mosquitoes in them, right? And I would love to investigate, trauma therapy. I think a lot of people could and should benefit from investigating the trauma that we all went through. That's what I think, and I think trauma therapy is something a lot of people need from 5 years ago. And probably don't even know it. That's the thing.
By way of relating, I have been sitting envisioning myself also in similarly chunky jewelry, full linen outfits, doing a grief counseling kind of something at some point. So maybe we need to take out a shingle and get on that.
Oh, listen, I'm in. I have the same thing. Grief counseling. I have a friend in the industry who just became a grief doula, I believe.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
That is fascinating to me. Not just trauma theory, betrayal trauma interests me. How to trust again, because no matter what kind of betrayal, it can really mess with your ability to just feel safe and have that inherent switch in yourself where you're not paranoid about every little thing or people's actions or that kind of thing. So yeah, let's get a shingle. We'll advertise it here. Everyone, come get healthy.
You do have a Golden Girls deep dive podcast. How did you begin that, and what does it fulfill for you? Why do you like, I presume you like doing it.
I do. I love it. We just won a Webby Award for.
Congratulations.
So I know I'm so excited. My friend Patrick Hines has a very successful podcast called True Crime Obsessed. And this was a baby he wanted to do for a long time. So I was approached. I guess it was January of 2024. And I said, oh, yeah, absolutely. I remember watching it with my mother. And I think that's the story of a lot of people. They watched it with their mother or their grandmother. And, it came out when I was a teenager, right? So I remember it, the OG release. And then, of course, in a syndication and then on DVD. And, no ever. So combing through it is just where we get some joy. We run to the booth every week to record. It's pure joy. I know it's work, but it is absolutely something we feel compelled to do. And it seems to have taken off, and we're delighted.
Congratulations
Thank you.
on the Webby Award. Congratulations again on the Tony Award nomination. The performance you're giving in Death Becomes Her is absolutely stunning. Just
Thank you,
so
Sarah.
fun. And I've been a fan for ages, and I'm very excited to have gotten to speak with you today. Thank you so much.
Thank you for wanting to and taking time out of your busy schedule and life. I appreciate it.
Jennifer Simard plays Helen Sharp in Death Becomes Her on Broadway. The cast album is available now from Concord Theatricals Recordings. Death Becomes Her is up for 10 Tony Awards, including Best Musical and Best Performance by an Actress in a Leading Role in a Musical for our guest, Jennifer Simard, and her friend slash foil in the show, Megan Hilty. Links to more information will be posted along with this interview at WAMC.org. I'm Sarah LaDuke, and you're listening to The Roundtable.
Wow, that was sad. Right? That was really, really sad. Oh, I've had a fulfilling life.
I love my kids.
I love my wife. So sad.
Do you ever wish that was what we had?
What? Ear hair you can see from space?
No, an ending.
I'd give it all to have an ending.
I'd give it all to say goodbye.
To finish up our plot, whether life made sense or not. To say the show is over.